From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from San Francisco.
It's very important to emphasize that cases like this one are central to the United States government's efforts to neutralize the threat posed by terrorists and those who support them.
A jury in Miami convicts Jose Padilla of conspiracy in one of the most closely watched trials since 9/11. We'll talk to his lawyer. Then here in San Francisco, the largest gathering of psychologists in the world. It's the meeting of the American Psychological Association. It's expected to culminate in a showdown on torture.
For years, the American Psychological Association has insisted that psychologists being involved in interrogations of enemy combatants helped make these interrogations safe and ethical. But the evidence has been overwhelming that, in fact, psychologists have been central in the Bush administration's regime of abuse and torture. And
Today, we'll speak with two psychologists, both members of the Coalition for an Ethical APA. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A jury in Miami convicted Jose Padilla Thursday in one of the most closely watched trials since September 11th attacks. The jury of seven women and five men found Padilla and his two co-defendants guilty of conspiracy to commit murder in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Chechnya, and providing material support toward that goal. The three men will be sentenced on December 5th. Padilla originally made international headlines in 2002 when President Bush declared Padilla an enemy combatant for allegedly plotting to set off a radioactive dirty bomb inside the United States. Padilla was stripped of all rights, transferred to a Navy brig in South Carolina, where he was held in extreme isolation for more than 3.5 years. Even though Padilla was a U.S. citizen, the Bush administration denied him access to an attorney for 2 years. Faced with a Supreme Court challenge, President Bush announced criminal charges against Padilla unrelated to the alleged dirty bomb plot. After 43 months of extreme isolation, Jose Padilla was transferred from a South Carolina brig to a civilian prison. Padilla's attorneys argued he was unfit to stand trial because of the effects of torture. Forensic psychiatrist Angela Hegarty examined Padilla last year and concluded the extreme isolation and torture had left Padilla essentially brain damaged. She appeared on Democracy Now! Yesterday in her first broadcast interview.
It's very important to emphasize that cases like this one are central to the United States government's efforts to neutralize the threat posed by terrorists and those who support them. I also want to mention that this particular case has long demonstrated the importance of integrating intelligence and traditional law enforcement tools in order to protect and preserve national security. And I think it stands as a great example of what can be accomplished when those things are combined.
But the judge allowed the trial to go forward. One of Jose Padilla's attorneys, Andrew Patel, will be joining us on the line from Miami. In Iraq, the coalition death toll in Iraq has now topped 4,000. The vast majority are American, with 3,700 and 2 U.S. troops killed. 44 U.S. service members have died this month. A former Marine sergeant has been charged with manslaughter in the killing of 2 Iraqi prisoners in Fallujah. The charges against Jose Nazario come as part of a wider investigation into the alleged killings of unarmed prisoners during the U.S. attacks on Fallujah in 2004. The Bush administration has made official a massive increase in military aid to Israel. On Thursday, Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns signed an agreement to give Israel more than $30 billion in weapons over 10 years. The deal increases annual U.S. military aid to Israel by 25%, or $600 million per year. The boost is part of a multi-billion-dollar military aid package to U.S. allies in the Middle East, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia. In Gaza, Hamas leader Sami Abu Zuhri said the military deals were a blow to peace prospects in the Middle East. In Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez has proposed several constitutional changes, including an end to limits on presidential terms. He unveiled his proposals in front of the Venezuelan Congress.
The presidential term is 6 years, and the president of the republic can only be reelected once for a new term. I propose to my people to modify Article 230 by having the presidential terms of 7 years, which was my original plan, but the assembly took it back to six, and that president can be reelected for a new term. Just that simple.
Chavez has also proposed reducing the maximum Venezuelan workday to 6 hours from 8 hours. The proposals would have to pass through Congress, followed by a national referendum. More evidence has emerged contradicting Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's account of his March 2004 meeting in then-Attorney General John Ashcroft's hospital room. Newly released notes show FBI Director Robert Mueller described Ashcroft as a feeble, barely articulate, and stressed before Gonzalez tried to persuade Ashcroft to sign off on the Bush administration's warrantless spy program. Gonzalez has denied he tried to pressure Ashcroft and said Ashcroft was lucid and did most of the talking during their conversation. Mueller's notes also show Ashcroft's aide was so concerned about Gonzalez's pressure tactics that he asked that only Ashcroft's relatives be allowed to enter the room. The notes also show Ashcroft complained to Gonzalez about White House rules that barred him from seeking the input of his deputies at the Justice Department. The U.S. coal company Drummond has been acquitted of liability for the murder of three union leaders at its Northern Colombian mine. An Alabama jury rejected allegations the company's financial support for right-wing paramilitaries made it liable for the killings. The victims' families maintain Drummond hired the masked gunman that killed Valmer Lacano and Victor Orcasita in March of 2001 and Gustavo Soler 7 months later. The jury did not reject those claims, but ruled only that Drummond wasn't liable. The families have criticized the Colombian government for delaying the deposition of a key witness, Rafael Garcia, a former senior official at Colombia's executive intelligence agency. Claims he witnessed Drummond's top official in Colombia hand over a suitcase full of money to pay for the assassinations. The International Labor Fund and the United Steelworkers Union filed the suit on behalf of the families. They say they plan to appeal the verdict. A veteran U.S. diplomat has announced he's stepping down one day after his indictment for allegedly making racist and threatening comments about Arab Americans. Patrick Searing faces charges for a series of emails and phone calls to employees of the Washington, D.C.-based Arab American Institute. One phone message was left for Arab American Institute President James Zoghbi during Israel's invasion of Lebanon last year. Searing is reported to have said, quote, "The only good Lebanese is a dead Lebanese. The only good Arab is a dead Arab. Long live the Israeli Defense Forces. Death to Lebanon and death to the Arabs." Searing is also said to have used the F word in referring to Zoghbi and what he called, quote, "his wicked Hezbollah brothers." Searing's 20 years at the State Department includes stints in the Middle East. In prison news, new figures show U.S. prison guards were responsible for more than half of reported cases of rape, sexual harassment, and violence in U.S. jails last year. More than 6,500 cases of sexual violence were reported overall, a 20% increase over 2 years. In campaign news, Democratic presidential hopeful John Edwards is facing questions over his ties to an investment group that's foreclosed on subprime loans to victims of Hurricane Katrina. The Wall Street Journal reports Edwards has $16 million invested in his former employer, Fortress Investment Group. Fortress has foreclosed on at least 34 subprime loans made to Katrina victims. Edwards has been one of the most vocal critics of subprime lending on the campaign trail. He says he'll divest from any stake in the foreclosures and personally help the foreclosed evacuees. Meanwhile, Edwards has joined rival Barack Obama in vowing to hold talks with Iran if elected to office. In an article in Foreign Affairs magazine, Edwards says talks with Iran would come as part of an overall push for diplomacy. But Edwards also says he would not rule out a military strike on Iran, saying no option should be off the table. Also writing in Foreign Affairs, Republican candidate and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani has come out against the creation of a Palestinian state. Giuliani writes the U.S. should oppose Palestinian statehood because it would inevitably encourage terrorism. Giuliani also says he would consider talks with Iran, but left open the threat of weakening Iran's economy and destroying its nuclear facilities. Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney has disclosed his personal fortune could top more than a quarter of $1 billion. Romney and his wife, Ann, are said to hold assets worth between $190 and $250 million, more than all other presidential candidates combined. Romney has already spent $9 million of his own money so far this year. Nearly half his fortune is tied up in undisclosed investments through a trust in his son's names. And in Utah, the search for six missing miners is on hold after a cave-in killed three rescue workers and injured at least six others trying to reach them. The six miners have now been missing for 11 days. It's unknown if they're still alive. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from San Francisco. A jury in Miami convicted Jose Padilla on Thursday in one of the most closely watched trials since the September 11th attacks. The jury of seven women and five men found Padilla and his two co-defendants guilty of conspiracy to commit murder in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Chechnya, and providing material support toward that goal. The three men will be sentenced on December 5th. Padilla originally made international headlines in 2002 when President Bush declared him an enemy combatant for allegedly planning to set off a dirty bomb inside the United States. Padilla was stripped of all rights, transferred to a Navy brig in South Carolina, where he was held in extreme isolation for over 3.5 years. Even though Padilla was a U.S. citizen, the Bush administration denied him access to an attorney for 2 years. Faced with a Supreme Court challenge, Bush announced criminal charges against Padilla unrelated to the alleged dirty bomb plot. After 43 months of extreme isolation, Jose Padilla was transferred from the South Carolina brig to a civilian prison. Padilla's attorneys argued he was unfit to stand trial because of the effects of torture. We'll now go to that clip of forensic psychiatrist Angela Hegarty, who examined Padilla last year and concluded that the extreme isolation and torture had left Padilla essentially brain damaged. I interviewed her on Democracy Now! Yesterday in her first broadcast interview.
What happened at the brig was essentially the destruction of a human being's mind. That's what happened at the brig. His personality was deconstructed and reformed.
But the judge allowed the trial to go forward. One of Jose Padilla's attorneys, Andrew Patel, joins us on the phone right now from Miami, Florida. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Your response to the verdict, Andrew Patel.
You have to excuse me. It's hard to summarize what, to me, is a human tragedy in a sentence or two. We were very sad, very disappointed, and had been hoping for a different verdict. We'd been hoping that Jose would be home with his family today.
Can you talk about what happened in the trial and what you believe led to this verdict?
In this trial, I think you have to put it in the context of federal conspiracy law, where the government doesn't have to prove that something happened, but just that people agreed that something should happen in the future. In this case, it was even more strained. The crime charge in this case was actually an agreement to agree to do something in the future. So when you're dealing with a charge like that, you're not going to have, or the government's not going to be required to produce the kind of evidence that you would expect in a normal criminal case, which is we sometimes describe as a whodunit. This is more of a who done what for who thought or agreed to do what, where, and to whom. You know, the government introduced no evidence as to victims of this.
Andrew Patel, can you talk about the wiretaps? How many wiretapped conversations introduced into the trial? Was it something like 300,000?
Well, there were 300,000 intercepts over a period of approximately 10 years. Of those, approximately 14,000 were considered to be, quote, pertinent. The government introduced about just under 130 conversations, or parts of 130 conversations. Now, of that 300,000, Jose's voice is heard on 7. And there are an additional dozen or so conversations in which other people are talking about him. So in a massive electronic surveillance involving home phones being intercepted, cell phones being intercepted, fax machines being intercepted, bugs in people's homes, we have a grand total of 21 calls that have anything to do with Jose, out of a grand total of 300,000 interceptions. Your audience can do the math. The result is, you know, just barely a pin drop in this tidal wave of sound that was recorded.
Andrew Patel, the other men, the co-defendants of Jose Padilla, Adam Amin Hassoun and Kifa Well Jayusi. Did you try to separate them? And what did it mean that they were tried together? Most of these conversations, of course, were involved them and not Jose Padilla.
Exactly.
And talk about the significance of their trial together.
It made things very difficult for us because there was a tremendous amount of testimony that, or evidence that the jury heard. For example, the government introduced at the trial a portion of the CNN interview with Osama bin Laden. And the jury was instructed that they could not consider that as to Mr. Padilla. But, you know, what a jury is told, we always presume that they'll follow the instructions, but that is a very powerful piece of prejudicial evidence that if Mr. Padilla was tried by himself, the jury would not have heard.
Do you plan to appeal?
Of course.
Where does Jose Padilla go now? When we were speaking yesterday with Angela Hegarty, the forensic psychiatrist who interviewed him for some 22 hours, she said that his terror was returning to the brig.
It is, and she's right. Mr. Padilla will stay in the federal detention facility in Miami until his sentencing. He will, and this is just my, shall we call it an educated guess or expectation, will be sent to a federal maximum security facility. The irony of that is that he will have more social contact with other human beings in a federal maximum security facility than he did in the brig.
Everyone says the most damning evidence was this Mujahideen data form that was described as an application to an al-Qaeda training camp of in northern Afghanistan.
That was the government's, you know, You know, when you actually look at this document, and it is clear that it was, there were two or three different kinds of inks. If you look at the handwriting on the first page and the last page, they don't match. Even things like in the United States, we will write a date, you know, month, date, year. And in Europe and the Middle East, they write date, month, year. And there are actually two dates on this form, one on the first page, one on the last page. One is in the European style, one is in the American style. We referred to this document as a, quote, questioned document, unquote. The jury has spoken on that issue.
The Wall Street Journal saying the verdict may bolster proponents of broad, warrantless electronic surveillance in the fight against terror, but could also vindicate those who back civilian courts and law enforcement for trying such suspects.
I think the folks who are looking for an excuse to continue or, you know, initiate unlawful wiretaps, any excuse is a fine excuse. There's certainly nothing in this case that would validate that. The wiretaps in this case were all court-ordered.
What is Jose Padilla's reaction?
I would vastly prefer that circumstances had permitted you to ask him of that question. And I think I'll save it for the answer for the day when he can answer that question for himself.
Is he able to process it?
I'm sorry?
Is he able to process the verdict? Does he understand it?
You spoke with Angela yesterday, Dr. Haggerty. Let me just say that nothing in the interim has happened to make him better. It's our belief that he was not, that this trial should not have gone forward. That matter will be addressed before the Court of Appeals.
And will the issue of torture be raised, being abused over the years, and the extreme isolation?
His competence and the way he was treated in the brig are completely interwoven.
The sentence he faces?
Maximum sentence on count one is life.
Andrew Patel, I want to thank you for being with us. Andrew Patel is speaking to us from Miami, where the jury handed in their verdict yesterday in the case of Jose Padilla, found guilty of conspiracy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we return, while we're here in San Francisco, we're going to talk about the largest gathering of psychologists in the world. And there's going to be a showdown this weekend, voting on a resolution around whether psychologists should be involved in interrogations and abuse, what many psychologists are saying, torture. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Torch Guantanamo Bay by Suicide Bid here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low-power FM college and community radio stations, on public access TV stations, and on PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network, channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, channel 375, also Link TV. And we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish and audio and transcript form at our website. I'm Amy Goodman, and we are here in San Francisco, where a group of psychologists are planning to hold a protest today over the refusal of the American Psychological Association to bar its members from participating in interrogations at military and CIA prisons. The protest is occurring on the opening day of the 115th annual APA convention. Unlike the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association allows its members to participate in detainee interrogations. APA representatives argue the presence of psychologists keeps interrogations safe and prevents abuse. But in recent months, a string of exposés in Salon.com, Vanity Fair, and The New Yorker have revealed that psychologists have played a key role in designing the CIA's torture tactics. Outraged APA members have introduced a moratorium resolution to be voted on this weekend. It calls for an outright ban on psychologists' involvement in detainee interrogations. Dr. Stephen Saltz and Dr. Stephen Reisner have been at the forefront of this effort. They're both members of the Coalition for an Ethical APA. They co-wrote an open letter to APA President Sharon Brem in June of this year, urging her to support the moratorium resolution. Dr. Stephen Saltz is a psychoanalyst, a psychologist, public health researcher, and professor at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. He's founder of Psychoanalysts for Peace and Justice and maintains the Psyche, Science, and Society blog. Dr. Stephen Reisner is a faculty member at New York University Medical School and a faculty advisor at the International Trauma Studies Program at Columbia University. We invited the APA on the program. They declined our request. So we welcome our guests here in San Francisco just before you head out to the APA convention. You'll both be participating in debates this weekend. Dr. Stephen Saltz, talk about how we have gotten to this point. There is a growing pressure on the APA. What is the background of this story?
Okay, well, let me try and tell it in brief, because we could go on for hours on it. But I know you've provided great coverage over the years, which we really appreciate. Going back since the days, was it 3-4 years ago, when we started getting hints in the press that conditions in American detention facilities were not quite ideal, that abuse, that treatment that probably meets the legal definition of torture was occurring in many of them, there started to be increasing numbers of reports that health professionals, psychologists among them, were participating in that in those abusive interrogations and the other abuse that's non-interrogation-related abuse at these facilities. As a result, the professional associations, the American Medical, the American Psychiatric, the American Psychological, were under pressure to do something. The the two medical associations eventually, though somewhat belatedly, adopted policies that said that their members do not belong in interrogations. As health professionals, their obligation is to help and do no harm. The American Psychological Association has not done that. They appointed a presidential task force on ethics and national security, the so-called PENS task force, in 2005. When the report came out, it was not signed by the members of the committee. However, it later was revealed that six of the nine members of this committee investigating, forming policy on the ethics of involvement in interrogations, were themselves from the military and intelligence communities, most with direct ties to interrogations. In other words, these were precisely the people whose behavior was potentially being reported upon in the press as being problematic were those who the APA chose to formulate its policy. And then they had them not sign the report. Since when does one hear a report where you can't read a list of the members? I've never seen such a thing. And since then, the pressure on the APA has grown intensely to change its policy. They maintain this psychologist involvement interrogations will make them safe, legal, ethical, and effective. Oh, this mantra has been repeated by every APA leader over and over again. And yet the evidence is, as you said, in those articles, in many other articles going back now a number of years, is just, and perhaps most critically from the Department of Defense itself, where in May, they declassified a report by the Office of the Inspector General, the OIG report, that explicitly said that military psychologists from the military SEER program, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, that trains U.S. soldiers to resist torture if they're captured by countries in which torture, that these techniques were reverse engineered to develop the interrogation techniques used by the CIA, by the military at Guantanamo and elsewhere in Iraq and Afghanistan. The OIG report is conclusive evidence from the military itself that the psychologists were central to this whole business. Over the years, the APA has not said one single word of concern about the role of psychologists, the role of psychology in abusive interrogations, in torture. They pass resolutions, psychologists do not torture. Well, you know, and so, of course, everyone's against, President Bush is against torture, Alberto Gonzalez is against torture, the APA is against torture. But like President Bush and Alberto Gonzalez, the APA has never seen torture. They have never acknowledged psychologists' role in torture, they have never acknowledged that torture is occurring. So again, so that's the background. They seem to be feeling incredible pressure this year, and there's a lot of parliamentary maneuvering going on, and we can get into the details there, but that's the background there.
We wanted to host a debate this morning on the moratorium resolution, but the APA declined our invitation. The director of ethics at the APA is Dr. Stephen Behnke. He was unable to join us, he said. But this is an excerpt from a debate that he had yesterday with our other guest, with Dr. Stephen Reisner on the San Francisco public radio station KQED.
We feel it is very clear for the American Psychological Association to be absolutely clear on what is an ethical interrogation and what is not an ethical interrogation. And if one takes a look at the current debate in the administration, there's a debate over whether harsh techniques are ethical or effective. The American Psychological Association's position is clear. Harsh interrogation techniques are neither ethical nor are they effective. We believe that it's very important to have that message very clear wherever interrogations take place.
I would say,
Dr. Stephen Reisner, you were the one in the debate with Dr. Behnke yesterday on KQED. Your response?
Well, there are two aspects of it, whether harsh techniques are ethical and whether harsh techniques are effective, and what the APA's position has actually been on both of those aspects. The trouble is, as Stephen Saltz said, the APA has stated over and over again that they are against torture, they're against harsh techniques. They have a new campaign in favor of rapport-building interrogations, and rapport-building interrogations which do not coerce, which do not torture. The trouble is that they have yet to articulate ethical principles which prohibit interrogations that are harmful, that are coercive, that are abusive. And so they change the subject and make the claim that the APA is against these things. But when you read the ethical protocols and when you read the resolutions, there are so many loopholes and there are so many openings.
What?
Well, let's take right now the APA is offering a substitute resolution to the moratorium. And in it, they do something which I think is a major step forward. They ban 14 of the harshest techniques. They come out against any psychologist participating in an interrogation in 14 of the harshest techniques as established by Physicians for Human Rights and Human Rights First. And that is a major step forward. However, what is left out is the fact that psychologists are not only guiding and supervising interrogations at sites like Guantanamo. They also consult on the conditions that detainees are kept in. The interview with Jose Padilla's lawyer showed so clearly what the effect of the conditions is on a detainee, not only how the interrogation is handled. So what the APA does not prohibit in its ethical principles or in the board substitute resolution is a psychologist recommending isolation over an extended period of time for a detainee as a way of, you know, breaking him down for an interrogation. They don't prohibit sensory deprivation in the general circumstances that the detainee is held in, only in terms of an active interrogation. So the loopholes are tremendous. They also don't say that you cannot do other abusive or enhanced techniques apart from the 14. They just mention 14 that cannot be done. They don't align with a higher principle, the Geneva Conventions, the UN principles of human rights. That's why I'm saying that Stephen Behnke can argue that the APA opposes abuse, but they haven't put it in writing and made it clear.
Let me play another excerpt. This is of the interview we did with Dr. Angela Hegarty yesterday, the forensic psychiatrist who examined Jose Padilla after he was released from military detention last year. And I asked her about the difference between the positions of the American Psychiatric Association and the American Psychological Association on the question of participating in coercive interrogations.
Well, the American Psychiatric Association principles of ethics essentially follow the AMA's, which is American Medical Association, yes, is no psychiatrist is involved in torture ever under any circumstances, period. There is no caveat that opens up the possibility by mentioning the Bush administration's qualifications on the definition of torture. That the psychologists are protesting and debating this is great news. Clinicians, our entire professional identity is clinicians, and if psychologists certainly see themselves as clinicians, people who care for people. Our entire professional identity as people who help people is obviated by such involvement. And I entirely disagree with any caveat that would allow a clinician to be involved in torture at any time.
What about the argument that those who don't want the moratorium are making, and especially high-level staff of the American Psychological Association, that for psychologists to be there is to bring ethics to the situation, to explain what is going too far?
Well, you know, I asked Mr. Padilla about that. He'd said that there were some decent people that he'd come in contact with, you know, especially in the latter part of his stay at the brig. And I asked him, I said, you know, if I were in a situation like this as a clinician, and I abhor what's being done to you, would you want me to stay, knowing that there's somebody who cares about you, who's ideally, hopefully, ethical? Or would you, albeit powerless, or would you want me to leave? And he actually gave me one of the first and only immediate and straightforward and direct answers. He would want me to leave. he would not want me there because for him, my presence endorses what's going on, even though, as I said, in my scenario, I would be powerless to do anything to change it.
Dr. Angela Hegarty, the forensic psychiatrist who interviewed Jose Padilla for 22 hours. Dr. Reisner, your response.
Well, I think there are two issues here. One is the clinical issue, whether psychologists in a setting like the Brig or Guantanamo can or should offer therapeutic aid to the detainees when their very presence seems to support the existence of such such places. And the other side of the issue is whether psychologists in such places should participate in the action of interrogation or the purposes, the governmental purposes, the military purposes of those sites. I think without any question it is clear that if a psychologist participates in the interrogations or supervises interrogations or supervises the conditions in an arena where there are no human rights and no due process, that that psychologist is contributing to the violation of human rights, and so there should be an absolute prohibition. On the other hand, whether a psychologist should or should not offer therapeutic aid is a complex ethical decision, and you have to weigh whether the aid offered outweighs the support, the possibility of being perceived as supporting the circumstance. But the APA is not really addressing that. We're trying to address the second contingency of whether psychologists should be actively participating in the military and intelligence aims and intentions in breaking down these prisoners or interrogating these prisoners at those sites. And we are saying that that is, in effect, a violation of human rights, no matter how ethically you ostensibly do it.
Do you think that the debate is changing this weekend at the APA, the American Psychological Association? And why also is the staff of the APA so committed to continuing what the AMA and the American Psychiatric Association have said no to?
Well, I think that the debate is changing because a year ago we had rumors that psychologists were involved. It seemed logical. Psychologists were involved in the SEER program. The techniques were SEER techniques. It seemed likely that psychologists could be doing this, and we wanted ethical principles that prohibited it. Between last year and this year, it's not a question of a likelihood. It's a question of revelations that these things have been going on and psychologists have been behind it. From the beginning, in the CIA, as Catherine Eban revealed in Vanity Fair, Mitchell and Jessen, with the obvious approval of people higher than they are, because it continued for a long time, used SEER tactics to torture detainees.
These are two psychologists.
Two psychologists. And then after that, the DOD got into the act. Psychologists were brought in, SEER psychologists were brought in to train other psychologists to use the same methods, to use SEER methods to interrogate. The Department of Defense itself has acknowledged this. We know that this has happened. Psychologists have been responsible for the abusive interrogation. So the membership is much clearer in what's going on and what we have to change. So the debate has changed very significant.
We have to break, but we're going to come back. We're talking with Dr. Stephen Reisner and Dr. Stephen Saltz. They are both involved with Psychologists for an Ethical APA. We're here in San Francisco at the annual gathering of the American Psychological Association, with debates culminating on Sunday with one or two votes around the issue, possibly, of a moratorium on psychologists involved in detainee interrogations, or with some kind of amendment to the previous resolution on this issue. We'll talk more about it in a minute.
To exploit the earth, hey, and you trust in their decision. your mind causes your defeat. And so you become an invention to distort the search. Propaganda and lies is a plague in our lives. How much more victimized before we realize? Hey, it's mind control. Mind control. Corruption of your thoughts. Destruction of your soul. Mind control.
Stephen Marley, Mind Control, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting today and on Monday from San Francisco to be at the American Psychological Association annual meeting, a real showdown happening this weekend. Today at 4 o'clock, there's going to be a protest against psychologists' involvement in abusive interrogations and torture. On Sunday, major votes taking place by members of the APA. We will cover that and bring it to you Monday. I want to play an excerpt of an older interview that we did with Dr. Stephen Behnke, the director of the APA's ethics office. He appeared on Democracy Now! 2 years ago, shortly before the APA convention of 2005. I asked Dr. Behnke whether the reports of psychologists' involvement in detainee abuse at Bagram, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo had led him to question whether psychologists should participate in interrogations.
I would say that for us, the question is not whether psychologists may be involved. We believe that there is an ethical role for psychologists to play. The question is, what are the ethical boundaries within which psychologists must remain when they are engaged in these activities?
Our guests are Dr. Stephen Reisner and Dr. Stephen Soltz. They're both with Psychologists for an Ethical APA. Dr. Soltz, respond.
Well, notice you asked him about concrete reports that abuses were occurring. He has nothing to say. No one from the APA will ever say, this is horrible. Psychologists have done horrible things. We need to do something about it. All he says is, we will set rules that say they shouldn't do this. Well, they don't follow these rules.
Dr. Kuchar, the former head of the APA, was also on Democracy Now!, and he said, give me some names. To talk about someone, for example, like John Lesso.
Well, John Lesso is a psychologist at Guantanamo, one of these behavioral science consultation teams that are called BISCUITS, Major Lesso. It's been documented that he participated in the torture of detainee Mr. Al-Qahtani that occurred in fall of 2002 and early 2003. Time magazine obtained the interrogation log, about 80 pages of this interrogation, a partial log. There's a log kept. I mean, this is a very bureaucratic torture regime. Every 15 minutes, there is a notation of what was done to the person. Mage L, as he's often referred to, is in that log. He was present in the torture room. This is documented. So after this business about names, at least four people have filed ethics complaints against Dr. Lesso, four that I'm aware of, going back to last August. I still look. Dr. Lesso is still a member of the APA a year later. So if these ethics, whatever these processes are, they seem to take forever and ever and ever if there's ever going to be any resolution. Of course, they're all in secret, so that, which, you know, for individual ethics business, this is a protection. But it's not so much around individuals. It's about policy. That's one of the tricks that Dr. Kuchar and Dr. Behnke use, is to turn it into individuals. Give us the name of individuals. This is classified activity. This is deliberately secret. Yes, we occasionally get a name here or there, but when we raise a name and raise concerns, we're accused of being unethical because we don't have total evidence. It's about policy.
I wanted to read from the Spokesman Review in Spokane. Very interesting piece. Expert has stake in cryptic local firm consultants tied to CIA interrogations. It says the former president of the American Psychological Association is a partner in a Spokane-based firm linked to the CIA's reported use of harsh interrogation techniques on suspected terrorists at secret detention centers around the world. Joseph Dominique Matarazzo, an 81-year-old former psychology professor at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, said in a statement Friday he serves on the board of Mitchell, Jessen Associates and owns 1% of the firm. According to public records, Matarazzo is one of five governing people in the Mitchell Jessen firm, which does secret interrogation consulting work for the CIA. Matarazzo refused repeated interview requests, but said in his emailed statement he's not and never has been involved in the company's operational decisions, that he only attends brief and infrequent company meetings. The statement was relayed by a spokesperson at the Portland Medical School, where Matarazzo taught behavioral neuroscience 50 years before his retirement in June. Dr. Stephen Reisner.
Well, here is an example of the APA has tried many ways of deflecting the issue of psychologists participating, organizing, running these abusive and torture regimes. And the APA's response has been, well, they're not members of the APA. And the APA's response is, give us names of members so we can bring them up on charges. Now we have an implication of a former president of the APA who owns 1% of a company of two psychologists who are clearly implicated in the torture of detainees. And the APA's response has been, well, we're not concerned about what Dr. Matarazzo does outside of APA administrative positions or politics. So the APA has managed to avoid taking a responsible position on where psychologists ought to be in terms of the ethical principles of torture, abuse, what psychologists have done, what our standards are, and done an accounting for all psychologists.
What would it say to President Bush if the American Psychological Association said no to participation in detainee interrogations?
I think it would be a very strong public statement, especially after the American Medical and the American Psychiatric, the American Nursing Association, the American Anthropological Association, the American Ethnomusicological Association have all made, and just last week, the American Translator Association have all made very strong statements. If the American Psychological Association, the largest mental health organization in the world, said, no, this is not right, we will not participate, I think it would be a message that would be heard. Whether the Bush administration would hear it, you never know. But I think Congress would hear it, the press would hear it. And we know after the psychiatrists and medical associations said no, that the military said from now on, we prefer psychologists for our behavioral science consultation teams. We prefer psychologists to psychiatrists because of the positions of their respective associations. So we know the military listens to this.
Also,
What
the American Psychological Association would be doing would be acknowledging that the torture has been primarily psychological torture, and that this would be an abuse of the principles of psychology. The Association of Ethnomusicologists has come out against the use of music as torture, but the American Psychological Association hasn't yet come out and acknowledged that psychology has been perverted into an instrument of torture, and has finally said that that would be against the ethical principles of this American Psychological Association, and it would call into question the complete regime of abuse and torture.
Does the American Psychological Association give these interrogations cover? Does it legitimize them? Could they go on if psychologists weren't there?
Could they go on? They could go on because there are professional interrogators. Why psychologists have tried so hard to position themselves in the field of interrogation is a question that I think ought to be investigated and ought to be questioned.
Jane Mayer, on your show a couple weeks ago, I think, put it very clearly, there's two parts of this. One is the supposed expertise of the SEER program, which is bogus, because SEER was designed to help people from breaking, not from giving information, but from becoming collaborators. You know,
American soldiers strong if they're captured and if they're tortured.
So they didn't, but it's partly about that, but the other thing is that the administration from the beginning has known that their activities are illegal and they've been concerned about the possibility of future war crimes trials. One way to they reinterpreted torture that basically you could do anything as long as the intent wasn't to harm. You know, as long as the intent, so to have a psychologist say this is a good way to get information gives the prestige of the profession of psychology to say that this, that yes, we can use these techniques because this is what science says, how we to get information.
I just wanted to talk about the schedule of this weekend and the track that's going to be happening. Dr. Reisner, you're going to go right off from the show to participate in the first session, What Are Psychologists Doing in U.S. Military Detention Centers, a track of the APA weekend. But I noticed that more than half of these, it seems, will be taking place during or after the vote on Sunday. Can you explain how that works?
Well, we have not gotten the impression that the APA board and administration has wanted there to be such full coverage of the mini convention on psychologist participation in interrogations. We asked them to put a brochure out and let the membership know. It arrived maybe a day before members were leaving for the convention so that they had already made their schedules for it. The town meeting to discuss members' feelings about and opinions about this participation is after the vote. Half of the meetings are after the vote. And this is supposed to be an education for the council members in order to help them vote. In fact, the board wanted the vote to take place on Thursday's meeting, yesterday's meeting, before any of this took place. We fought them and fought them and fought them. But I believe that there is enough, especially with the coverage that it's been getting here and elsewhere, and with the rally, I think that there will be enough opportunity for the council members to be educated.
Where will the rally take place today at 4 o'clock?
At the Buena Vista Gardens, Yerba Buena Garden, the Stone Stage, today at 4 o'clock.
Here in San Francisco.
Here in San Francisco.
And just to clarify as we wrap up, do you expect there to be, or are you demanding a vote on moratorium on psychologist participation in torture on Sunday?
We are demanding a vote on both. We want there to be an up or down vote on the moratorium so that psychologists go on record. Whether they are supporting or not supporting psychologists' presence in these sites. And we would like a vote on the board's resolution because it adds important caveats to the entire issue. I just also want to say that the events are listed on the website ethicalapa.com. And a lot of the issues are laid out more clearly on that website.
Are an increasing number of psychologists withholding dues from the APA?
Yes.
Well, we're going to continue the story on Monday. Last comment, 10 seconds, Stephen Saltz.
This is a very important chance for the APA to finally do the right thing, and I hope that they do so.
We're going to leave it there. Thank you both, Dr. Stephen Reisner, Dr. Stephen Saltz, with Psychologists for an Ethical APA. And I want to also thank our friends here at Link TV, where Democracy Now! Also broadcasts. It's great to see John Hamilton again, who's here at Link, was with us at Democracy Now! For years. Also thanks to Heather Herford and Mark Erickson and Brian Moran and Fred Tetzner and the rest of the crew here in San Francisco. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, Aaron Maté, Elizabeth Press, Jeff Hagerman, Anjali Kamat, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Carrie Mache. Our website is democracynow.org. There you can get our headlines, the transcripts of our broadcast, our video and audio podcasts. And we'd also like to get your opinion as we continue to broadcast from San Francisco. Also on Monday, we will cover this historic vote of the APA. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Special thanks to Sharif Abdelkadous and Dennis Moynihan. Thanks so much for joining us.